Are you suffering from back pain? Well, I've got the thing just for you. 15 surefire tips for relieving back pain, plus 192 others just in case, volume 1, available at Amazon.com. Over 30 million Americans are suffering with back pain at this very moment. The vast majority of these cases are either caused or exacerbated by common lifestyle factors. Many of the same factors may be causing you pain right now. Join board-certified physician Andrew Kirshner as he guides you through the parts of your life where these problems occur and gives you simple, safe, and effective solutions for these common daily pitfalls. In this fun and informative book, you will learn how to identify the aspects of your life which may be causing you pain, how to create a back-friendly environment, how you can improve your pain by improving your sleep, ways to make a pain-free commute, how you can perform daily activities without making your pain worse, and much more. Andrew Kirshner is so well respected in the field of back pain relief. He has, famous clients such as DJ Jazzy Jeff. He has done many talks and lectures at universities in the UK. He has appeared on QVC demonstrating back pain relief products, and that is because he is an expert in his field and people trust him. Also, check out the 5-star reviews on Amazon.com. This is the book that you need if you suffer from back pain. That's 15 surefire tips for relieving back pain, plus 192 others just in case, volume 1, available at Amazon.com in paperback. Check the link below the show for more information. And welcome to another episode of Turnchuckle on BBG Wrestling. I am Pablo, and with me is the Phineas I to my Henry O, Foxy from Grapple Arcade. How are you doing, you pig? You filthy pig.
I'm all right, you dirty hog. I'm canny.
Do you know what I stood for?
Hang on, let me
see. And O.
Phineas.
I know what O stood for. I can't pronounce it. I can spell it. But I think I was the same, but with... the same word, but with I at the start instead of O.
Really? Oh, yeah. Is it? Give me a hint. Is it like sort of pig related?
No, you'd never get it. Well, I mean, it could be because you never know. But it was. I think you spell it O P H E R U S, so Ophrus.
All right. Okay.
And I think I was. I mean, no one remembers that. Like, you know, it was in a magazine at one point.
I was going to say awful until you said, and the I is the same. But with an I.
I think it is.
So there's it awful and iffle.
Awful. But I don't think they ever... like, I do know that the week before Phineas came in, no vignette or anything, Vince just said, oh, Henry's brother's showing up next week. And he said brother instead of cousin. And then they changed it because cousin sounds more inbred, I guess. You know what I mean? Because they are rednecks. And that's, you know, how... WWF sees anyone from the South in overalls, basically. So, so he showed up the next week, and they had a daft laugh. And within like about a month, there's the famous match on Superstars with the Godwins against the New Rockers, where the Godwins brought the Basset Hound down to the ring, and it had a lovely little shit in the ring.
It did indeed, and hilarity ensued.
The referee had to kick it out with his own fair shoe, and Marty Jannetty just pissed himself laughing. That needs to be on the network, so I'm sure it is on probably like Funniest Moments or whatever, you know.
I remember that. Well, that happened more than once, though, didn't it? A shit in the ring based on the Godwins being in a match.
Is that a comment on there?
It's actually not. No, it's not. I'm not criticising them and saying that they were shit in the ring. Yeah. I didn't mean it like that. I mean, like, there was literally an animal shit in the ring.
See, that's
sure there was.
That's
was
the
not
one
in your house?
No, this is the only one that I know. And I think people might have assumed pay-per-view just because people have somehow gotten the footage of it and it's not on the network.
I think it's on a video, you know. You know what it might be on? Was Sonny... There was Sonny part of that at the time. Was Sonny support managing the Godwins?
Sonny was
like, or was she doing something with the Godwins at the time where she was flirting?
Well, she used Phineas, basically. She, like, you know, Phineas wanted Sonny, as everyone did in 1986. And
did she appear in that match, like, at ringside or something?
She did. Well, that's the thing. She, like, she was the gold digger. So once the Body Donners lost the belt to the Godwins, she went with the Godwins. She used Phineas's stupidity to get them to sign the contract. And then, but
was she on commentary by any chance for that match?
No, because she cost... No. What, when the Godwins won the belt?
No, the shit in the ring.
No, she's got nothing to do with it. I think we're crossing wires here, man.
No, I thought you... Because all I'm going to say is I might have had the Sonny VHS tape when I was younger off a mate who left it around my house for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if it was on that video that the shit in the ring happened.
No, because Sonny wouldn't have had anything to do with them at the time. But look, we'll save this. We'll save all of this for like an actual definite show
about shit in rings,
about any time shit has been used in wrestling. I can already think of a few. One of them was also in 1996 with T.L. Hopper in the swimming pool at SummerSlam, diving down to pick up a turd, and then he ate it. But then they said it was like a baby roof or something like that. But
what we'll do is we'll probably not do that episode.
Why not? We could do a shit in the ring episode and use the King of the Ring logo and just use the word shit instead. Look, I don't think anyone's done a full episode on a podcast, and there's probably a reason for this, but we are here to, like, fill that niche of, you know...
The fetish.
That fetish.
We're the only wrestling scat-related podcast going.
Oh, I bet
Pod-scat.
We're not.
Pod-scat.
I bet we're not, you know. I bet there's other wrestling scat-related podcasts out there, but...
Pod-scats. Sorry, let's move on.
It's unbelievable that we've actually, you know, we're on a platform and we've got a sponsor, to be honest.
Anyway, today we're going to be talking about somebody who shit themselves in a match with The Undertaker.
Well,
let's move on.
Yeah, well, that didn't come up. Psycho Sid is today's guest, and it was a lot of fun chatting to him. Let's get this out the way first, because Sid has a podcast and a book coming out. You heard that right. Sid has a podcast, which will be happening very, very soon. And we'll talk about that a little bit, because he is a very talked about topic in the world of wrestling podcasts as well. So it's him, you know, giving his point of view, telling stories, all that kind of thing. So the things we didn't ask him, because he's probably been asked by every other podcaster / interviewer going... I didn't ask him about his leg. You all know about his leg. You all know about the scissor incident with Arn Anderson. You all know about the rumour about him shitting himself at WrestleMania. And any leavings, firings and stuff like that. To be honest, I think, you know, we go a bit to the, you know, take a bit of a left turn with it and dive into other areas like his character development. And
I really like Sid when he first came to WWF, and he was the first person where it was really, really difficult to tell whether he was a goodie or a baddie when he was actually meant to be a goodie, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, I remember being really wary of him, but really loving who he was and what he was about, and the whole Sid, you know, when he was wearing his baby blues, obviously, the first time around, but being very, very wary of him before he turned. It was almost like you could sense it was going to happen at some point. Mm-hmm. But it was just really, really interesting, because I was just, when he was the face, Sid, I was always just super cautious of him. And,
He kind of came in out of nowhere. I mean, you know, I was actually familiar with him in WCW before WWF, because of WCW in 93 was huge over here, like the UK exclusive Galoobs, all the videos, and they were cheaper, so they were easier to get a hold of and stuff like that, and it was on ITV, so, you know, that's...
Well, I was aware of the Hasbro before anything else. I just remember getting the Hasbro, like, and then just being... It looking mint, I don't know what it was, it was just, it looked cool, this guy with permed blonde hair and bright blue trunks. I was like, get in, this is going to be my world champion.
It was very visual. It's kind of weird, because he's probably the only or the biggest named wrestler in the world who has moved between WWF and WCW so many times, but he was always at the top, you know, at the top of the card, and you know, there's a reason for that. And you know,
how would you downplay somebody of that magnitude and that size? You know, he's already been up there with the big guns, but whether people like it or not, he was a huge draw, and he still is. He's the same. He's the kind of guy, when he came out recently, you know, there was that that thing on Raw.
Heath Slater, yeah.
He got a massive pop for that, and people loved seeing him back, even if it was just for that one off, you know, 10 minutes. It was great, and I think a lot of people for a long time online, before that had happened, had been like clamoring for him to make a return as a bit of a cameo or something. And when he did, it was awesome.
Well, and I mean, God, intimidating. I mean, when we met him at the Love of Wrestling, and he hasn't lost any of his height or his stature or his intimidating look or anything. And it turned out nicest person in the world to talk to, and a very misunderstood person. But
he loves sausages. He loves sausages.
You know, it's kind of every time when I had to call him, I was nervous every time, because you know he so played that character so well that you can't even imagine him as like a normal.
You can't shake it off even on the phone.
Not really. And there's like that bit of like sort of he's not angry at all, but he just sounds angry all the time. And I was like. You know, and he's got that very sort of like cutting sort of, you know, no nonsense way of speaking as well. Because, you know, I do this from my room currently, and there's lots of wrestling stuff everywhere. And I was like, yeah, I apologize for like the amount of stuff that I just had in the background. And he's like, well, you're the mark, not me. And I was like, you know what? I am. I'm very much the mark. Because there was like Sid stuff hanging from the walls and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, he appreciates his fans. And he's one of those, like Ahmed Johnson, where if other people with bigger platforms can control the narrative of someone, then people start to believe it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I understand that that's why his podcast, you know, might be deemed necessary by him, and why his book's coming out as well. And I'm sure that...
Oh, I'm really looking forward to both of those, massively.
It'll be a heck of a read and a heck of a listener as well. So, yeah, we go into all of that. So, I think, without further ado, unless you've got anything you would like to... Oh, yeah, the guest announcement after the interview as well, and we'll tell you where you can find us and all that kind of stuff.
Indeed.
So, without any further hesitation, this is our interview with the master and the ruler of the world, Psycho Sid. This week on Turnchuckle, I have with me former WWF and WCW World Heavyweight Champion, the master and the ruler of the world, and the host of what is sure to be one of the most talked about wrestling podcasts anywhere, Vicious Circle. He is Sid Vicious. Hello, how are you doing?
Hey man, how are you doing tonight? Or in the morning for you?
It's 1 a.m, but I'm kind of used to it now because, you know, I go by wrestler's schedules, you know, they tell me what to do, you know. It's not my place,
right.
You know, which is fine by me. We met in the UK in Liverpool for the Love of Wrestling, so you had a good experience there, I assume.
Man, I'll tell you what, it was one of the best times I've had in a long time, and Andrew, the guy I put on the show, that might have been one of the best shows I've ever been on, from all him, all the people who worked it, the fans. I've never seen anybody, of course, the English people are so giving and so kind. And it was one of the best trips I've done maybe since I've been out of the business.
Would you say that you don't do these lightly? You're kind of selective on which ones that you choose to do. This was, I believe it would have been your first time in the UK since, what, 2000 maybe for WCW?
Maybe, right.
So, you know, for you working in front of like European crowds, is there more of a, I guess like an enthusiasm or a passion maybe compared to like other audiences? Or
it is, and the difference is I can't even put a finger on it. Where like if you were, of course, when I was there working with Bigelow, you're working with the right person, and that you know the kind of fan. You don't force an England fan to cheer when they want to and stuff like that. You got to let them get behind what they want to. And when they get behind it, you got to go with that moment and be able to stay with that moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one thing that I've been told when interviewing different guys over the past couple of years is that there's kind of an enthusiasm that you might not get, and nothing against American audiences, it's just that we don't get to see, you know, big WWE, WCW, big name wrestling a lot, especially back then. You know, it's slightly more different now, but there seems to be kind of it's easier to believe, I guess, because it's easier for everyone to get into it and enjoy it a bit more, and there's not as much cynicism there. Do you find that? Or
I think the main thing that the first time I'm overseas I notice is that first you guys hadn't had a flood of wrestling or overflood of wrestlers that have seen them in live events. So when we came over there, it was like the Beatles coming to America.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was. Now, it's sort of changed a little bit since then. But still, it's that type of enthusiasm, that type of greeting. When you get greeted like that, you remember that, and you want to go back.
Yeah, and it was at the for Love of Wrestling, it was a huge, huge treat to be able to get to meet you, because, you know, some of the guys who were there at the show have done, you know, various UK appearances for conventions and stuff. But I assume that, you know, you'd want to come back whenever you can. Based on that one.
No, you definitely want this. Those are the ones you want to come back for sure. Mm-hmm. And never been treated so good. Great location, great restaurants, good people. No, I definitely want to come back. And also I'm going to be doing a book for then. So I'd have something really to share with the people overseas.
With the book and the podcast, is that kind of an attempt to clear up a lot of the rumors that are talked about on various wrestling podcasts, not just by fans, but also by big names as well? You know, you are a highly talked about topic. So are you aware of the amount of rumors that there are out there about you?
I'm not quite aware, but I have people call me all the time telling me they heard this about this on this podcast and this on that podcast. So you're 100% right. It's for that as well. Mm-hmm. First we thought about what a great way to promote the book. And then we started thinking, when I hear these things people are saying, this would give me a really chance to bring out on the open a little bit and make some of these things honest.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find... you know, I can't necessarily speak for you or the wrestlers as well, but I do seem to find that it's kind of unfair when a narrative is put out there, especially from such a big platform, say WWE or a well-known wrestling podcast, and then the person who's the subject of it doesn't get a chance to give a rebuttal or whatever. So, you know, I can imagine that the podcast... And I'm sure you're not into the idea of, like, you know, burying people or anything like that, but it's just kind of, you know, get the truth out there and tell some really fun stories as well.
Well, that too, and then introduce some really cool wrestling fans to other wrestling fans. Like, we did a call-in tonight with a lady named Maggie, then a guy out of Atlanta, Georgia, named Jeff Arthur, who's... It's going to be on our show almost like Beetlejuice is for Howard Stern. Uh-huh. Really cool kids, you know, off a little bit in the head, but he's cool to talk to. But no, things like that, you know, what I like laughing, mm-hmm. so I want to do some funny stuff. But main things, like you said, I want to bring a couple of things every once in a while and talk about why this was said or why this was said the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And just clear it up a little bit. Because the thing is when I was introduced to social media, I considered it sort of like dirt sheets. I never read one, never looked at wrestling magazines. I never looked at a booking sheet to see who I was working with. Those things didn't matter. Just be on time, work really hard. Those things mattered the most. So again, by doing this, I'll be able to clear a few of those things up like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, from like hearing the different podcasts, but also like watching your career as well. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, it never seemed to be like a politically motivated career or anything like that. It was just kind of, you know, be yourself and, you know, right. they can take it or leave it, I guess, you know, but most.
That's exactly what, exactly. That's why, again, I didn't look at booking sheets. I didn't know who I was working with. I gave everyone I worked with as much respect as I got. Mm. So, and that's what you do in this business. You take care of the other person. I always did that. Everyone took care of me and then just get along. So, again, I'm just going to use this platform to clear up a few things and maybe set a few things straight.
That's great. So, Well, kind of completely 180 sort of thing, but I just recently interviewed Austin Idol, who was one of your first tag team partners. That just seems like such a odd combination. How did you gel with Austin, and were you the Sid that you would become in WCW a couple of years later at that time?
No, actually, I was Lord Humongous. And this is the very first night I did the character Lord Humongous. And I won't go into it deep, but I was told somebody didn't show up for the, like, they had a 2-week run for this character and someone didn't show up. So they brought a new character out, Lord Humongous, and put it on me. And I did it for like 2 weeks in Memphis. And that was my first little run. But so I was, get back to what you're asking now. That match that night, the first match was with me and Austin against Nick Bockwinkel and Jerry Lawler. And I remember walking to the ring, and I'd worked out with Austin that day. We ate lunch. And on the way to the ring, he said, "Hey, man, flex." And I could not get one of my muscles to move. I'm not kidding. I don't think I had muscles back then, but I couldn't flex. And I just remember, think about this. Here was my first match. I'm main event with Nick Bockwinkel.
That's crazy. I mean, it seemed kind of like a Lawler thing to do, that he would have the big monster, whether it be you or Kamala or, you know, guys like that, and they would kind of start out on top, win, like beat up Lawler to start with, and then sort of then work their way back up the roster to have the rematch with Lawler sort of thing. Is that kind of what happened with you?
Well, for me, it happened like in one night because, again, whoever was supposed to be in that spot didn't show up for whatever reason. They'd bring people in back then for just a couple of weeks. You know, they'd only run the shows like Memphis, Louisville, Evansville, and Nashville. Mm-hmm. So I got to do that like that, 2 or 3 weeks around the loop, and that's all I called for. So, but it was a lot of fun.
And Lord Humongous was in the mask as well, wasn't he?
Right, the hockey mask. So, and the thing about this is, had that horrible suit that Jerry Lawler had. It was horrible looking. But it was, I tell you, it was probably one of my worst outings because I didn't know what I was doing. Mm. But that was my first outing.
Was the mask kind of there for that purpose? So then when you would re-debut as a, you know, a different character, then people wouldn't have known that you were Lord Humongous because you had the mask on at the time.
Yeah, I guess that was the catch on that. And then, too, that character had been used all through the South and down in Louisiana with Bill Watts. And then it was a character off that movie. And I think it had been used in Memphis by a guy named Mike Starks. I actually knew Mike Starks. He was a strength coach at University of Memphis. But he did it before me, and that was actually his costume. And I guess Lawler made it for him, so he kept it and then handed it down to me and actually still got it in my closet.
Did it fit?
It might go around my neck. Yeah, I don't know. It's just like a piece of black nylon.
Yeah.
You know, with a couple of white, you know, pearls on it or something like that. A little ugly fur, you know. I actually made my own when I went down to Continental. I made it handmade up with leather and real rabbit fur. Of course, it was stupid looking too. But it was much better than the first one.
See, that's the thing. Jerry Lawler's an artist. We would have thought that he would have made a better costume than that, but
he wasn't wearing it.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. So you were trained by Tojo Yamamoto. Like, what was he like as a trainer, and what did you pick up from him? Because I mean, I can't imagine it was things like promo skills or anything like that. What was his big
influence? Well, I remember his influence was the facial expressions.
Okay.
You know, I guess I had them and he saw that. But every time I did something, it was like, that face, you know. And then he taught you toughness too. And everyone, including me, went through that kendo stick. And we got a taste of it every Sunday afternoon. And so, but what it was is the more you could take, the more you respected him, the more he respected you. Of course, that was a silly way of going about things, yeah. You know, getting strapped with that kendo stick. But I remember taking it proudly. And that's just a good guy, Tojo.
So you say back then that you didn't have the physique that you would end up having sort of thing. So what was your like body style like? Was it just kind of more just undefined? But you were still big, sort of thing.
I was lean, you know. Right. I think probably was right there at Lord Humongous time. I was probably 285 with a little baby, you know,
body fat. And then as time went on, I got over 300 with no body fat.
How old were you at that time? Because, I mean, you must have been very young, like early 20s. So.
Yeah, early 20s.
So was it one of those things that, like, everyone saw money in you at the time because you were that big, you were that young, you had the facial expressions? You know, you can learn to work over time, I guess, you know, one of those kind of things. So was it when you were in Memphis, was it Lawler or was it Jerry Jarrett who was running it at the time? Because I know they would, like, sort of change.
I think Jarrett ran it all the time, and the Lawlers were watched the Memphis side of things because that's where he was involved at. But I really remember working with and talking to Lawler the most, not really Jerry Jarrett. Mm-hmm. To see him once. Well, I actually saw Jerry Jarrett's mother more than I saw him when we did the Louisville show. But no, it was Jerry Lawler for the most part.
And I've got to say as well, I mean, I can imagine it would be impossible not to learn from Jerry Lawler. Because for me, Jim Cornette once said, you know, Jerry Lawler's facial expressions and body language is so good that you could be sat at the back row of an arena. He could have his back to you and you could tell what emotion he had on his face, sort of thing. So was it kind of, was it a lot of like fear sort of thing when he was in the ring with someone your size? And
no, I'll tell you, Lawler used psychology like everyone that came through Memphis did. And like you said, the facial expressions. And one of the things I learned in the Memphis, and I remember Jerry Jarrett saying this to me when I was doing the Lord Humongous character, and I knew what it was. I wasn't showing enough expression. He said, Sid, when you think you're over-exaggerating, you're probably not exaggerating enough. And that's what I sort of picked up from all those guys.
So where did the sort of the psychotic sort of element come into your character? So, because I want to talk to you about how it evolved over the years as well, but where did that start?
Well, I guess as I came out of Lord Humongous in Continental, I was coming back home to Memphis. I've been gone for over a year from home. So I was coming back and we thought this was a good time to come out of this. And the Japanese promotion I was working for didn't like Lord Humongous and they wanted a different character. So from Montgomery into Memphis, I changed the character from Lord Humongous to Sid Vicious.
Mm. So was it kind of a, did you sort of practice facial expressions in the mirror, the laugh, the sort of shouting, etc.?
Not in the beginning. First, you always see the facial expressions, let's say, in the mirror when you're driving or when you're brushing teeth and stuff like that. But we hear that. We don't always think. We're always thinking the simple things first. And first thing was just getting to the gym and get yourself big for this business. And so then, like you said, and then I remember this being, Paul Dangerously was my manager for those 2 weeks at Lord Humongous.
Right.
And he'd been sitting up all night long in front of the mirror with that sea breeze splashing his face, making all these facial expressions. So you couldn't get away from that. Everybody was doing that. So what happens when your interviews come around, they come around somewhere. Mine started coming around with Sid Vicious and WCW. Then that's when I got the real help to lead me in direction to do interviews and stuff like that. And then that's when they really started taking off. It was like a competition.
I can imagine. Yeah. And when you came into WCW as well, I mean, you hear lots of stories about the management with Jim Herd and everything, but I mean, was it Jim Herd who brought you in or was it Ole or?
Well, it was actually Eddie Gilbert. Jim Herd was the, I guess you consider it the GM or something like that. But he was the guy in charge. I guess everybody said he worked for Kentucky Fried Chicken, but as a GM. He did, I guess. But anyway, he was there when I first got there. And Jim was a pretty good guy.
So I can imagine in WCW, because it was kind of still somewhat of a build, but there was an interesting dynamic that you were, I mean, the Skyscrapers, you know, were incredibly over, both as heels and as faces, but you were kind of in the Horsemen, but as heel, but also as a face as well, because everyone just gravitated towards you. So was that kind of a weird situation to be in at the time?
The thing about it was, I think it started from my first taping in WCW at Center Stage. When I came out, I acted as a heel, talked as a heel, reacted as a heel. But when I dropped down to that knee the first time, the people went crazy. So, I think it was just, when we really look at it, it's timing, too. When I was coming in, that was sort of the forefront coming forward, was that that type of character. Mm-hmm. It wasn't any more Lord Humongous characters. That was in the past.
Yeah. Well, and as well, when, you know, WCW tried those kind of, I don't want to say ridiculous, but kind of the over-the-top sort of cartoony characters, I don't think they did it as well as the WWF could because of their marketing department, you know, et cetera, and Vince McMahon, obviously, as well, you know, with his, I think their character development or whatever. But WCW had a lot of serious, no-nonsense, just kick-ass athletes, and those were the ones that really, you know, like Doom, the Steiners, you know, the Horsemen, etc. And those were the ones that sort of really, you know, the roster at the time in WCW, I mean, they couldn't really be touched. And
it's... No, I agree with you 100%. The roster was, this is the difference, and people comment like you're commenting. What it was is WCW was still, okay, this is our niche. We're wrestling.
Yeah.
Okay, and WWF is wrestling, okay? And so they really hugged into that and didn't let that go. And not really, I guess, until probably the NWO.
Right, yeah. No, totally. Well, one of the first times I ever saw you was actually during your 93 WCW run after Sid Justice. And it was just one thing that you always did that kind of stuck with me, because I love it when a wrestler acknowledges the camera because they're acknowledging the audience at home, sort of thing. And it was after you would go for the pin and you would crawl to the camera and sort of, you know,
right,
directly sort of look into it. So, I mean, were you always conscious of not just the audience at the arena, but the audience at home?
No.
Really connecting with that camera?
Right? Well, that the audience in that camera was your biggest audience.
Yeah.
And most of the time in my wrestling career, we always had those 3-minute matches, and that was getting to the ring and back. So, and I just was starting the interview, so I had to really utilize those 3 minutes. So as I came through the curtain, I'd find the first camera and I'd go to it, and I'd start an interview right there all the way to the ring. Then I'd get the guy in the ring and get him over to the corner, get a camera right there. Then I'd do some more of the interview. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, at the finish, when I got done walking out, I'd finish the interview, you know, so that's what people remember. I tried to work on those things like that. And I figured if I did all these things, that everything I can do like that and add them all together, that I might get over.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's the Jim Ross line, maximize your minutes sort of thing. And you, again, from the moment you walked out to the moment that you went back through the curtain, everything was memorable sort of thing, whether it was a squash match or whether it was a longer, you know, pay-per-view match or anything like that. And it really did leave a lasting impression in me, and which is why I'm a fan. And I'm trying not to kiss your ass, but, you know, it's just, it's one of those things. But,
well, no, like I heard Roger Federer say about himself today, you know, they were asking him, was it fair that the guy he's playing that day didn't get a full day's rest? He said, well, what would happen? I would still have the competitive edge. Mm. And that's why I look at things like that.
Absolutely. So when you went to the WWF 91 as Sid Justice, because there weren't really any vignettes or anything, you just kind of showed up. But that speaks to your name value, that you could just show up and everyone knew who you were. So were there any sort of meetings where you were required to do anything dramatically different to Sid Vicious as Sid Justice, or was it just do the same and get over sort of thing? Or,
well, we won't spend the rest of your time talking about it, but what happened was, is I was supposed to have had this deal where I was only going to do TVs and pay-per-views for 1 year. And so they were in that mode, and then they had to get rid of the Ultimate Warrior at SummerSlam, I think it was, and they had to put me in right away. So that's why we didn't have time to do that character. So I had to jump in right away. So then that's when we started doing some TV things and stuff like that. But unfortunately, I've always been in this position where I had to be rushed into something right away. Fortunately, I've been able to pull it off.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's been the difference between me and sort of separating myself from the rest of the people in this business.
So there was kind of a noticeable shift in character. Obviously, when you turned heel, it was kind of you were still yourself, but there was that extra edge of paranoia, which I really loved. Which kind of give you that maniacal sort of
edge, and like you believed that you were the master of the ruler of the world, but it was also, if anyone doubted it, that you would, you know, put them on the stretcher and, you know, you beat the hell out of them and stuff like that. So the WrestleMania 8 thing, what would you have been doing, do you know, at WrestleMania 8 if it wasn't the Hogan match? Because obviously things got moved around because it was meant to be Hogan Flair and everything. What would you...
No, that's what's been... That's the wrong... That's a misconception. That was supposed to be me for now. I was supposed to be at WrestleMania when I came into the WWF. That was the deal, that I was only going to do TVs and pay-per-views till WrestleMania. Then I was to become the world champion at that show and start house shows. And that was going to be a real different thing than the one done. And I agreed with that.
As a face or a heel?
As a baby face.
Wow. Okay.
So then we'll talk about it in my book. And I don't have time to talk about it tonight, but there's a lot of things that made that happen where I had to go in that direction.
Oh, that's so. When we'll talk about more of the book as well, and when you have links to buy and everything, they'll all be posted and everything. Because that's the thing, I don't want to give away too much of what's going to be in the book, sort of thing. So was it the same situation at Survivor Series '96? Because when you won the title for the first time, the story was that it was meant to be Vader winning it and then losing it back at the Royal Rumble. So was that a last minute thing, or was that planned in advance, or was that just, is that a complete misconception?
That was another last minute thing. And we're going to talk about that in the book as well. But that was probably my turning point for me in my career. And what had happened was, real quick, we're running out of time, is that I was working at the Madison Square Garden with Vader, and I've been working with him up to that point every night. And I was as a baby face working with him, then I was a heel if I worked with Sean. At this time, I was the only person doing that. One night as a baby face and the next night as heel. And I was really pulling it off.
Yeah.
So I'm working with Vader in the gardens. They come to me instead as a baby face, have me go over. They want me to put him over because he's going to be working with Sean at the next time, the month or 2 months after that, getting the world belt from Sean. And like you said, dropping it to him at Sean's hometown in San Antonio. So me and Vader did a match, really did it. I won't go into it. Just a top wrist lock. Place went crazy. When I came out, the finish was this. He caught me off the top of the crossbody, planted me in the ground, and did a moonsault. 1, 2, 3. So when I came back through, Vince was sitting at the curtain, and I knew at that moment things had changed. And then got to the dressing room. I told, I think it was Bob Holly, Ron Harris, or Don Harris, and whoever else was there. I said, when we get in your house at Indianapolis, they're going to tell me that it was changed, that I'm going to be the one that's going to win that belt. And that's exactly what happened.
Wow. So, I mean, and the thing is as well, when you came back after, so you were in '95 with Teddy Biasi and everything, and then you were going to have a tag title match at Rumble '96. I don't know if you remember this or not. It was might be you and Wanted Free Kid against the Smoking Guns. You got injured at that point, I'm guessing, and that's why you were gone for a little bit.
Right.
But when you came back as a face, there just seemed to be another dimension to your character as well, because you were very actually fan friendly and fed off the fan reaction and stuff, almost like Psycho Sid needed the fan reaction and the kind of the approval, because that gave him the power, kind of like the Hogan thing and the, but for the 90s and for the new age sort of thing as well. Were there any conscious changes that you made to what you did at that point when you came back and became champion, etc.?
No, when I came back, right before that is when what happened, again, I was taking the Ultimate Warrior's place. He'd been fired again.
Crazy, isn't it?
And actually, I was just coming home from a balloon festival, me and my wife, in Greenwood, Mississippi, and our housekeeper said, some guy's been calling here, Vince McMahon. And I was like, don't answer the phone. And then, so I answered the phone. It was him. He goes, Sid, I need you to do Baltimore. I've had to fire the Warrior, and I need you to replace you. And I haven't been on TV for a year. I said, Vince, tell me that you can find someone with more TV power than me. I've been off TV for a year. He goes, no, I need you for this show. And so I did the show. Now, I came back the next week and did one. And first one was maybe Baltimore. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But the second one I did, then they asked me to do the pay-per-view at Vancouver. And then by doing that, it sort of gave me that year off, of that time off, let me get refreshed a little bit.
Yeah.
And when I came back, I think the people were – and then two – it left the door sort of open for me. They're getting rid of the Warrior. They got to find somebody to push. So they put me in that spot. And that's how I got, we'll talk about someday. It's called, I got myself off the whipping post. When I got myself off the whipping post, then that's when I knew that I was who I was.
That's great. Well, obviously, you know, we don't have too much time because you're very busy and everything. But just a couple of things. How did you enjoy your time in ECW, those appearances that you made?
Man, it was just like it was. It was fun. I didn't just went in and did something. There was no interviews, stuff like that. They didn't want me to get over. But again, it was those kind of reactions with fans. You can't ever, you know, duplicate that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. And I love the do you wish that they had done the stretcher gimmick more? Because it was so good. Like,
yes, I do too. I think the fans wanted to see that. And I think Vince didn't do that because of that very reason. And then too, that those kind of things really got me over. So they always wanted to rein me back a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't want to put me on the starting line and say, okay, Sid, you run as fast as you want. We're going to let everybody run fast. And if you can outrun these people, you can go. Well, that wasn't the case.
Well, just a quick question, because I know I won't be forgiven if I don't ask about it. At the Love of Wrestling, there was a barbershop set up. How many people wanted you to smash up that barbershop when you were there?
A lot of people, but I didn't want that shaving cream all over my face again.
Yeah, to be fair, I mean, it's so ridiculous that that happened, but it actually made you look even more intense and scary.
Yeah,
with the shaving.
I know. I was mad, but when I saw it, it really did look cool.
You have Vicious Circle, your new podcast, which is due to come very, very soon.
Today the first episode aired here in the US.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, give me the link if you don't mind, and all links will be posted and everything. I'll get your guy to give me the link.
Yeah.
You have the book, which is due, and you also do a lot of charity work as well. So would you like to chat about that? And I'll post links.
Yeah, what we try to do, there's two charities from the church at St. Mary's Cathedral I go to. One is called West Tennessee Haiti Partnership.org, and it explains what we're trying to do. That's called Fill Up the Tuition Gap. And that's if you sponsor one kid, and I think it's like $700, that kid gets to go to school, and their handicap, missing, you know, something's wrong, like missing an arm, leg, or something.
Yeah.
So they get to go to school for the year, or they get food for a year, and then they get what little medical help they can get for a year. So that $700 goes a long ways. We had a caller tonight named Maggie Donna Williamson from Louisiana. She last year donated, there's about 200 of them. We need multivitamins worse than anything for children's multivitamins. But she sent 200 toothbrushes, 200 toothpastes, 200 combs last year. So I'd like to say thank you, Maggie, for that. Then we got a simple one we do on Saturday mornings. It's called Pop Tops, and a guy named Drew Woodruff runs that. You can get in touch with him at St. Mary's Cathedral. And what we do is we help out by giving two cans of Viennas, pack of crackers, a moon pie, bottle of water, and maybe a bag of raisins. And Drew gives out about 150 of those every Saturday. Now, that's Drew's own deal. He's a retired welding supplies man. He doesn't have any money. He doesn't get paid from church. So this is a tough deal for him, and any kind of help we can get on that, we appreciate it. And you can always look him up through the directory at St. Mary's Cathedral, Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, that's wonderful. As someone myself who works with adults with special needs, and I have a sister who I care for who has special needs as well, that's a beautiful thing that you're doing as well. And there's something, I guess, as well, that you can lend your name to and your notoriety to as well. And it must bring attention to the charities that you're involved with as well.
You know, this is the thing is, it does, but this is what you find out. I find out, especially with the West Tennessee Haiti Partnership.org again, is that people just don't care. You know, here it is. It's an easy sell. You look at this little girl, this little boy's missing an arm, a leg, or whatever, and they're just trying to get through the day. And Haiti, guys, it's a third world country, and people who are handicapped are discarded. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're there, because they don't have a place to go. And the people on Saturday mornings are a great group of people coming there for those meals, but they're not there because they want to be. They're there because they're hungry. And this, I heard this on my radio station I listen to. It's called The Weevil, 89.9.org. And the guy, and we don't have commercials. And the guy says about a statement, it goes, think about this for a second. If we gave every time we thought to give and didn't give, yeah, and we gave at that moment, think of the things that might have got done. And the first thing hit me was that old saying, maybe cancer would have been cured. You just never know. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say as well that I don't necessarily believe in sympathy, but I definitely believe in empathy, like placing yourself in someone else's shoes. And once you do that, it really does, it brings it home, sort of thing. And, you know, it could happen to anyone at any time as well. And,
no, you're right. This is the thing is, I'll read my common prayer book, and the prayer book says those things. It's like you said, feel empathy.
Yeah.
You know, put yourself in those guys' shoes. Say, for instance, you know, and my prayer book tells me this, tell me to try to be a better person. Like, if somebody's walking in front of you at the store and I'm getting there first. Stop.
Yeah.
Let them go by. That's what we need to do more of. I'm working on doing that. And that's the hardest thing in the world for me, let anybody go in front of me. But I'm working at it. You know what I mean? So that's what we got to do. We got to do more things like that. We got to give when we think not to give and to give anyway.
Yeah.
We do those things like that. We're going to get that tuition gap done for West Tennessee Haiti Partnership, and we'll get a few more of those Vienna sausages for those good people on Saturday mornings.
That's wonderful. Well, look, there was so many topics because you're just fascinating. And again, I'm a huge, huge fan of you, and I'm just appreciative that you've given me half an hour of your time.
I appreciate it too.
Might there be one more match, or is that it?
I don't know. I just never know. A couple of years ago, I was having a lot of fun with it still. I've been so busy lately, I just don't know if I could anymore, but you never know.
It was a highlight for me when you came out on Raw and beat up Heath Slater. It was, I rarely get off my feet anymore and completely mark out, and that was a huge thing for me. That was really cool. And any more acting roles coming up as well?
No, not right now.
Mm-hmm. But I very much enjoyed River of Darkness, and it's a fun watch. Everyone should check it out if they get the chance as well. Got one of the greatest shots of you with the full gimmick on, with your eyes, you know, just the look that only Psycho Sid Vicious, Sid Justice can pull off, which is amazing. So look, thank you very much. All links will be posted below, and everyone should check Vicious Circle as well, which will be available very soon at a link, which I will get off your guy. And thank you very much.
Thank you, man. You guys have a good night.
You too. Thank you, Sid. That was a pretty action-packed, full interview within the time that we had, because he's a busy man. He really is a busy man. And he's getting the word out about the podcast and everything. And we're just grateful that he gave us some of our time and was very accommodating as well. And it was a big deal for me. Big deal for me because, I mean, our first former world champion, which is, a good sign of things to come as well. And
when you think about it, we've kind of sort of been chatting to him on and off since April when we met him in person, and sort of having a bit of crack with him for the last few months. And then he's one of those ones that catches you off guard. He said, "Should we do it now?"
It really was.
Yeah. All right.
It really was, Sid. As well. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, and not give too much away or anything like that. But it's a bit of like a back and forth to try and arrange times and stuff. But I'm at the mercy of the wrestler.
And, wait, the mercy of the master and ruler of the world.
Well, I'm at the wheel of mercy of the Danny. Whatever.
Yeah.
Dimmer. We'll forget it. So it was one of those things that I knew I had to call him at a certain time, and which was I was knackered. And then he was like, "Right, let's do it now." And I was like, "Oh, right, okay, give us a minute." And then I just stuck my head in the sink full of ice.
got yourself psyched up for Psycho Sid. Out of curiosity, who was your favourite Sid? Like, what was your favourite version of Sid?
It's kind of hard to say. I world champion Sid. I really loved that period from about mid 96 to about WrestleMania 13, because that's when the title picture really picked up. And it wasn't just like two people, and it became slightly more shooty, and it was the beginning of Bret's heel turn, and like in very early stages, but also the rise of Austin and stuff like that. Sid very, and this sounds crazy, but Sid could have gotten lost in the shuffle there. And he didn't, because he has his own unique, style, and obviously the size and everything as well. And
well, let's be honest, it was probably also beneficial for him that Sean wasn't very fond of Vader, so he kind of arguably stepped into where Vader was maybe being poised to be. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, well, I mean, as he says in the interview, it was largely stepping into where the Ultimate Warrior.
Well, it was, yes. But, I mean, for me, after that SummerSlam match between Vader and HBK, it kind of felt as if Vader was being... Yeah, exactly. And Vader was kind of cast aside a bit. And I think Sid stepped into that void, if you like, of the monster that HBK was the David to, if you like, the David of the Goliath to.
Well,
it worked. It worked a treat. I mean, for me personally, I don't know if it's just me or other people might agree, maybe even yourself, mate, that early 90s Blue Trunks Sid, that whole time when he was in WWF then, it was really confusing because of everything that was going on with Hogan at the time. And I don't know, there was just something a little bit unsettling about it where you didn't know what to take away from it with Sid.
I think there was more of a subtlety to his character, and that went into what
I think it was
about.
Lost. I think the nuances were lost with that character at the time because everybody was either super super goody or super super villain, and Sid was like, is it fair to say he was one of the, you know, he was an early version of a bit of a tweener, really, where you couldn't, like I was just saying at the beginning, you couldn't really tell goody or baddie, and then he had, you know, negative tendencies, if you like, whilst trying to portray a bit of a goodie. It was difficult. It was for me anyway. I found it quite tricky, but I loved the look and loved everything about him, and I was so glad when he came back. I didn't really dig the whole time with Million Dollar Man, the corporation, I won't lie. I thought that was a bit of a waste of time for him, to be honest, but it got him back in the shuffle at least anywhere, and then we had ended up having his cool little feud with HBK as well.
Well, that's the thing. With the, like, 91-92 run, I don't think WWF were ready for how popular he was going to become. Because, I mean, look at the end of the 92 Rumble where Sid was meant to turn heel. The crowd cheered when he eliminated Hogan, but then they had to dub it in and redo the commentary and stuff like that at the time. Getting Monsoon and Heenan to basically say the same things as well, but it sounded so done in a studio sort of thing as well. But it could be said that, like, companies generally maybe didn't know what they had with Sid. I think the 95 run, it really made sense, but because he, you know, turned on Sean and everything, because, you know, he's paranoid and all that kind of thing. But going with DiBiase, he doesn't seem like someone who, like, the character would be in it for the money. Sort of thing.
Yeah, completely. That's why it didn't really work for me having him in that kind of show. I remember sort of some in the WWF magazine at the time as well, there were some shots with Sid in the locker room and DiBiase talking to him, and I think Tatanka was kicking about or whoever was in that photo shoot at the time. And it was kind of looking at DiBiase's sort of his henchman, basically. And it always looked odd seeing Sid in that situation because you just thought, you know that he's meant to be a nutcase. You know, that's his character. So what was he doing there? He felt much, much bigger, not as in height, but much, much bigger as a star than that whole team combined, if you like. It just seemed odd. Well, didn't seem to fit.
I always had, like, sort of, you know, because you do, like, fantasy, not booking as such, but sort of, like, backstories or an extra bit of dimension to it and all that. And, you know, you could say that because Sid always wanted to rule the world, so having the title would mean that it was, like, official, or the fact that maybe DiBiase was paying for him to stay out of the loony bin. You know, because that ended up being the storyline where, you know, I mean, Sid talks about once you have two title matches on pay-per-view, etc., the only way you can go from that point is down. And nothing against the 1-2-3 kid, but when you start teaming up in a tag team, you're not going to be main event.
That's
again,
right.
Anytime
yeah,
soon.
Boss.
So they made the storyline.
That was like, it. Was 1-2-3 kid, not Tatanka. Sorry, Dolan Corporation kind of timeline slightly.
Well, he teamed up with Tatanka at King of the Ring '95, which, I mean, it's one of those events. I mean, we'll talk about it in great length, I'm sure, at some point. But I think as you get older, like, personally for me, I only just realized how great Sid is on that event, because the idea was Sid is frightened of Diesel, so he walks away and then leaves Tatanka to get beat up. But how Sid walks away, he kind of in his mind, feels that he's gotten, like, the upper hand on Diesel, even though he totally hasn't. He's just walked away and acted like a coward. But, like, you can see that he's justifying it in his mind. Then that led to the lumberjack match where he couldn't leave the ring and all that kind of stuff. And it's one of those things, once you start losing cleanly in title matches, there's only one way to go. But, you know, the...
Softball.
I thought it was a really fun interview.
I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it was an honour to have him on, and even just our commerce with him. If you like, our chats with him beforehand.
You think $1 million corporation again?
I'm stuck in. I've got money on the mind, man. With the lack of it, even. No, it was like chatting to him in April when we got to meet him in person. Everything from our discussion about sausages, leading up to being able to get him on the show was just marvelous, really. Fantastic. Yeah.
Well, next week, a bit of a 180, as is what usually happens. Like, I don't think any guest has been directly similar to the previous guest, which I guess is a very good thing. It's Kevin Sullivan.
Kevin Sullivan.
Yeah, the Taskmaster, the Prince of Darkness.
Your local butcher. I mean, you know.
He only serves the special stuff, you know. Kevin, I mean, again, lovely, misunderstood. You know, my image of him when we chatted, I just imagined that he was sat on like a throne with like flames going out the back with two Rottweilers on each side, you know what I mean? And, you know, that's how I kind of imagined it, but in like a robe and all that kind of stuff.
Let's leave that vision in people's minds, so let's not give any more away about it.
I'll tell you what, one of the most fascinating, you know, I've been very lucky to chat to a lot of wrestlers, and the interview with Kevin Sullivan, it does not go in any direction that you think it's going to go.
It's all over the place, and it's interesting.
I think I'll leave it at that. And I think he's one of the most passionate talkers. No, talkers isn't the right word. Orators, I don't know. Of classic wrestling ever, and you really get an insight to him as a fan of wrestling as much as anything else. And that's all I'll say about
He loves it. It's great to hear that he still does, which is awesome. You know, more than anything else, it's great to hear that even now, regardless of whatever's happened in his life, it's amazing to see how much passion he has for it all, and he's willing to have a chat about his passion. It's awesome.
It really is. So yeah, many other really cool names coming up very, very soon as well. Yep. And before we go, we should plug everything. We should have done this at the start, but we're still learning. We just ran on far too much. Basically, you can find Turntruckle on Instagram. Just done me 1,000th post. I threw a little party, had a little bit of cake, where I like thanked everyone because it. I didn't really see, you know, the milestone of it. I understand that it's 1,000 posts and everything, but then you look at what has been achieved within that 1,000 posts in terms of like building the show, and you know, I've got you, Foxy, to thank for a fair bit of that.
I got you, babe.
So yeah, find Turntruckle on Instagram if you want to see Rare Wrestling memorabilia and my rantings and videos of cats and all that kind of stuff. Where can people find you?
Well, you can find me mainly on Twitter. That's where I lurk at the moment. Slagging everybody off. I'm not really, I don't do that at all. But you can find us on Twitter at Grapple Arcade. You can find our Hands Off the Merchandise show, which is all about retro wrestling merchandise and paraphernalia, such as 1992 WWF sticker books, old ECW figurine toy lines, stuff like that on our YouTube, Grapple Arcade. And you can also find our mothership on Twitter, which is at BBG Wrestling. So that's at BBG Wrestling, which hosts ourselves, this Turntruckle show. It hosts the Broken But Glorious podcast as well. And lots of other things and cool things coming up, actually. Our site should be done pretty much, well, hopefully within the next week if you're hearing this. We should be tidying bits and bobs up with it. So the site will be there. It'll be a bit of a hub to everything that we do. We'll announce that one probably on the Kevin Sullivan show, actually, to promote that. We've got loads of things coming up, some really, really cool affiliation, actually, with a couple of other external businesses, shall we say, where there's going to be competitions online to take part in for free and to win some cool prizes as well. But more of that to be announced shortly.
Yes, don't you hate it when people make announcements about there being an announcement?
A pre-announcement. Let's arrange a meeting to arrange a meeting.
Yeah, I'll get my people to talk to your people, and we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. It'll be fine. Okay, well, thank you everyone for listening. Check out the other shows, and we will see you all next time.
Good night.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.